Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's Saura Saura from The Gloaming. And, well, we all know about The Gloaming on this programme. Their singer, Éireann O'Linnard, I'm delighted to say, is my guest this evening, picking the tunes. Éireann, good to see you.
Great to be here, John. Thank you so much.
You're looking very well in your hat.
Oh, well, I'm going to take it off now. I'm going to give it a rest. It's a bit crumpled, but some people think that's deliberate, but I washed it and it came out like that.
What kind of a hat is that?
Well, I bought that in a junk shop. They call it a Bordellino.
A Bordellino?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a very good Italian hat, but it cost me the princely sum of $40.
Good man.
So that's okay.
Good man. You like a good hat, don't you?
Well, I think it needs must.
Yeah.
The state of affairs being as they are, I need to shield myself from solar radiation.
Very good. Well, Éireann, it's great you're here.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, thinking about you on the way in, because, I mean, we've known each other for years and I know the kind of music you like. Mm. And you're as bad as me. It's pretty wide-ranging. And I thought, you know, it's okay for me doing it every night of the week, but if someone like Éireann has to pick a bunch of tunes for one night only, how do you even begin?
It's actually like, it's not possible. There's so many things I wanted to play, could have played. It's like anybody. You know, you can't. I mean, luckily, I think in my own headspace anyway, I feel I like listening to lots of different kinds of music.
Yeah.
And but everything on this list, I actually happen to love one way or the other, and there are different reasons why. But, you know, some of them are covers. You know, I like the originals. There's a lot of stuff I probably would have included. It's an impossible task. I was talking to my son about it, and I ran it by him. He's got much better taste in music than me, and he's 17. So, but I do love all these pieces, so we'll see.
Is this what you'd call, for want of a better word, a kind of an honest, unshowy list in a way?
Well, I think so. I actually love all of these artists so much, and I'm very familiar with each of these pieces, and in fact I'm even more familiar with some of the original versions, but think that they were reimagined in an interesting way, in quite a different way, some of these songs. We can get to that later.
All right, well, look, let's get underway with the first choice, and this is something I don't know, although the name is familiar to me, and I'm wondering if it's you. Or did some other guest play music by Goran Bregovic one night? I wonder. Tell me about Goran Bregovic.
Well, I mean, he's a very unusual character. He kind of stands outside the composer tag, even though he's a composer. But what I've always loved about Goran Bregovic is that it introduced my head and my ears to sort of Serbian, Balkan, Shannos, if you like.
Mm. Because there's a definite connection between this and what you do.
When you hear it, it's so
pretty
obvious,
evident,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You must have said that to you straight off.
Immediately, yeah. In fact, when I put it on first, I thought, is this one of his own? Is this himself?
Well, I wasn't going to do that. But, yeah. But no, the truth is, also what he introduced me was, it's like, they're travelling music from that part of the world.
Yeah.
The gypsy music in Goran Bregovic's delivery of that kind of culture is so rich and so beautiful and so fun and so mad. And the culture that gives rise to this music is fascinating. I saw a documentary on Channel 4 many, many years ago on one of the singers that he works with a lot of the time. And mafia are involved in big payouts and cash-only deals and big family events.
Show business. You know, I remember now. I think it was Eliza Carthy may have picked a track by Goran Bregovic. That would make sense, too. I think it was her. Anyway, here it is. What's it called, Éireann?
Well, this one is called Lento Arabesco.
Mm-hmm. Tales and Songs from Weddings and Funerals.
Yeah, it's a good title. Actually, I have my friend Ron Aslan in London to thank for introducing me to this record many, many years ago.
And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. And that was the first choice of my guest tonight, Éireann O'Linnard, who is picking the tunes. Every Sunday night we get someone in to pick the music. I'm delighted Éireann is with me. Have you set the bar very high there with that one? That was something else, wasn't it?
It is so beautiful, I think. And the way it's produced by the composer, you know, the
Goran Bregovic.
Yeah, Shadows of Bulgarian singing, that beautiful choral effect, and then the intimacy of the one voice when it clarifies. It's all very powerful.
It's extremely well produced, isn't it? Because when that there were those clear moments where you felt the singer was literally in the room here.
In your ear.
Not easily done.
No, I mean, you have to want to do it, first of all. Mm. And you have to know that it's something you need to do.
As a traditional singer, Irla, you must listen to that and think, God, the world's a lot bigger than Kool-Aid, really. Because I mean, that's, you'd be hard-pressed to identify where that comes from. It could be Connemara. It could be Pakistan.
It has a bit of the Qawwali singing from Pakistan in it, you could say. It has those ecstasies. It has the intricacy of the Connemara Shanlos. And also it has sort of the vowel sound of the Irish language is in there, for sure. Long ago I came to the conclusion that what we do is unique, but is also has brotherhood with many other forms of singing. Mm,
yeah.
And it's actually beautiful to know that.
Yeah. And, I mean, of course, language itself, you know, it has its roots. I was reading the other day about the word Derry, as in the city, but, you know, oak wood and all the rest of it. But that goes back to an Indo-European word called dur, and then it goes back to the Greek and dryads and all the rest of it. It's all completely connected up.
We basically don't know how people moved around prior to the Bronze Age,
yeah,
or even around that period. As somebody told me recently, I saw something on TV, we were talking about it, that about 6,000 years BC, there was copper being mined in Eurasia. And it didn't actually come to this part of the world till about 3,000 years ago. But when it did come here, it came here because people from that part of the world discovered that we had a lot of copper.
Right.
And they came here with their expertise and started mining in Kerry. And what did they bring with them? Stories, songs, know-how, abilities, tendencies, languages.
Let's talk about Kool-Aid.
Mm.
The way you described Kool-Aid to me once before, it made it sound like it was a remote, enclosed paradise of a place. Am I completely wrong?
You're not really, because I mean, I felt that when I was growing up, that it was probably an illusion, in terms of, you know, you make your own world depending on the geometry of it and the size of the walls. You're not aware of what's beyond the known universe, shall we say?
Yeah.
And my known universe when I came to Dublin, apart from radio, which was another kind of galaxy, was Kool-Aid, and it was very complete. Sound culture was very complete. The customs and rituals, the observation of spiritual practices, they were all very integrated.
Mm.
It was all kind of a system, you know, and I was very embedded in it because I was in the choir and, you know, I was therefore a very regular churchgoer and sort of performing all those rites and rituals. So it did feel very integrated and complete and kind of made sense. But of course, there was that wild virus, the radio, you know, and, you know, I was just talking to my brother the other day, about, he went to see Donald Fagen last year, and he and I used to be into that music, you know, back in the very early 80s. And, you know, what could that possibly have meant to my head? Those illusions, those languages that Donald Fagen would be speaking, those, because he's very clever, it meant nothing except that it excited my ear.
But even the feel of that album, Nightfly, which was a staple of late night radio. I mean, it was on.
That's right.
All the Mark Cagney, people like that would play that all the time. I used to listen to it myself. But the way you describe Kool-Aid as complete, you could equally describe it as isolated.
No, absolutely. I mean, and you know, I was even more isolated because we lived like 3 or 4 miles from the nearest village and on a mountain, 12 kids, 2 parents, 2 grandparents and 1 granduncle, 17 pairs of shoes.
Wow.
And really, we had our own little society. And I, you know, we worked on the farm, and there was a sort of it was very complete, but it was very, very remote. I do think when I came to Dublin in the very early 80s, it was just so exciting to overhear other conversations, to widen your mind.
Mm.
And I mean, I learned so much from just hanging out with people.
Before we get to Dublin, because there's a track on your list that would be perfect to play. But in terms of the singing, and you're still in Coolay at this point, were you part of a traditional whirlpool of singing, or were you just a good singer who was singing in the church and so on and so forth and got interested in it somehow? Was it in the family blood, for instance?
It was in my family, and I suppose a number of unusual things happened to me, if I was to be totally honest, when I was very young. Things that normally don't happen and probably shouldn't in some ways, but I was kind of singled out as a singer when I was very, very small. I mean, I was recorded in this parish, as it's called, when I was seven. I was recorded for LP when I was 12.
Yeah. So as a traditional singer?
As a traditional singer. And I mean, when I came to Dublin then in 1982, already, if I mentioned where I was from, people already knew what that was.
Yeah.
So, and my great aunt Elizabeth Cronin was where they say the singing came from in my family.
No, Elizabeth Cronin, or Bess Cronin, as you
Bess Cronin, yeah,
is an absolute legend in terms of traditional music.
She is. She was sort of discovered to the world, if you like, by Seamus Ennis, and then he brought Alan Lomax to visit her and other people thereafter.
Did you know her, Irla?
I didn't when I was growing up. Just the other day, I was talking on stage somewhere instead of singing, and I was saying that we had an old cassette that was doing the rounds when I was a little boy, a bashed up old cassette. I still remember it was white with sort of orange and white paper, and she was singing on it. I don't know where it came from. It was before her stuff was formally released, but growing up, she was always being mentioned, always. Or people would say, oh, he has a bit of Bess in him, you know, that kind of thing. Which, you know, you can decide to cash in on that forever, but it becomes a tired story after a while, other than that she's a magnificent singer.
And the other thing, of course, that area, that's Oireachta country.
Well, absolutely.
So I know Patter and the church choir and all the rest of it, but what was your connection with the Oireachta family as such?
Oh, very close. They were only 2 miles away from us. We were more or less the same age. I think there's seven of them. And they used to come up and play in our house, and we were hanging out in their house very often. And I didn't really know Sean very well. I remember seeing him in church, of course, as a young boy. I think I may have been at one. I'm pretty confident I was at one choir practice when he was at the helm. But I knew his wife very well, Ruth, and I'm very good friends, really, with all of his family. And I still know them to this day, every one of them.
Shadow is the wrong word, but it's a huge presence in a small area, isn't it?
Well, actually, it's an interesting presence, because members of the Oireachta family that I knew, like Alistair and Owen and Leah, they were very, very tuned into popular music.
Mm.
Very tuned in.
He was tuned into a lot of things as
well. Music down that house. you know, I think I first came across Paul Simon down that house, and Joni Mitchell, and various other kinds of artifacts like that.
And of course, Oireachta himself was listening to jazz and classical and all the rest.
Yeah, I mean, when you went into his, you know, I grew up in a regular house. My father was a teacher. My mother was taking care of an enormous amount of kids, although she writes and she's a very learned woman. But when you went to the Oireachta house, like it was just a different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
You know, Sean had a room there, and you had, at one point, you had an ancient bower on. You had so many science fiction books and other kinds of books, tons and tons of records. You had some sort of a copy of the Saturn V rocket. You had kind of it was a thing that you kind of went, oh, this is a different way of living.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe it's something I kind of wanted for myself.
I know you left home, and here's the song. What about this one, Anthony?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, I love Dylan's version, of course. Dylan wrote it. I think Philip King was telling me he wrote it in a hotel room on a very small reel-to-reel. And Bob Dylan's original version is very, very beautiful. But Anthony Hegarty's version is actually more beautiful.
Anthony Hegarty of Donegal, really. His people are Donegal people. Anthony is now a Noni.
That's right.
We're confusing our audience here. But this is Anthony when he was still known as Anthony.
Mm.
And this is I Was Young When I Left Home. And that's Anthony there, and I Was Young When I Left Home. The choice of Irla O'Linnard, who's with me in studio, picking all the tracks tonight. Irla, when you first were exposed to what you might call pop music, and I use that term, you know, that we're really talking about Paul Simon and all the rest of it, you said you heard it in Sean O'Reilly's house.
I heard a lot of music down that house, that Pather's siblings, Sean's sons and daughters were playing, and my own brothers actually were playing a lot of stuff too at home. That time you'd have a these things called a super scope, one speaker stereo with a cassette. And you remember you'd record programs at night and you'd make your own mixtape.
Yeah.
Of course, the joins were terrible, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the Walkman came in. I remember I bought a Walkman and the first record I bought for my Walkman was Dark Side of the Moon.
Right.
And that was brilliant in super stereo.
Yeah.
You know, where your stereo is clamped onto your head. That was like made for super stereo.
And did you personally have any issues, or the people around you have any issues with this great prodigy of a traditional singer from Coolay playing all this kind of Farden music?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what people mostly have problems with, looking back, is the extent to which you do things to the old music and the nature of the manipulations.
But even before we get into that, because we'll talk about that later on, I guess, with the gloaming and all the rest of it, but just in terms of listening to stuff, did anybody say, what are you listening to that old stuff for?
No, no one ever said that to
me. Good,
good. No, and in fact, in my own house and in these other houses, I never felt... I felt it was an enormous opportunity to listen.
Yeah.
And I think you and I both are contemporaries in that sense that... You know, radio was, and music because of radio, was everything.
Yeah,
it was this other world.
Yeah.
It was an ear to the world. It was a tongue from other planets, and it was profound for us. You know, that those days, you'd look at a record cover for hours as you listen to the music, seeing deep meaning into every little design.
Yeah, but you ended up knowing the address of Atlantic Records.
No, you ended up knowing that.
the phone number. But the thing about that, and I suppose some people nowadays might find that hard to believe, everything's so accessible now, or it appears to be, that the way you could kind of dwell in, and in particular, Dylan Springsteen, Joni Mitchell, those sorts of people. Now, whatever about punk and the rest of it, which I loved, the thing was, if you were on your own, as you always were on a Friday night, in your bedroom, and you're in the middle of a Bob Dylan album, you really are in another world.
You're
and
right.
I know those lyrics not from studying them, but just from listening to those songs over and over and over again.
Of course. I mean, they were our world. They're pure and simple. They were our world. And Dylan, of course, I think very much is a storyteller, is a Shanachie, is a shaman, is a seer, a prophet.
Now, those last three terms he would reject outright.
Of course he would, but that's fine. He has to reject them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think people who really have that sense don't want to go on about it.
Mm.
It's okay for us to say it, though.
Yeah.
Because I think...
I think it's true, by the way.
I mean, it is, I think, profoundly true in his case.
Yeah.
He's more than a brilliant wordsmith and poet. There's something else going on. He can speak for us. He can say things on behalf of the group, and he can remind us of things that we need reminding of. Joni Mitchell's different. I mean, she's very personal and complex. But I think Dylan has extraordinary relationship with both the public and the private.
Mm.
You know, and he kind of invented that relationship.
Yeah. And what's the, okay, you've got a Bob Dylan song on your list. How did you go about picking a Bob Dylan song?
Well, I mean, it's impossible. That's the bottom line, you know. I could have picked...
Well, we've already had one, in fairness, just to say. The song Anthony sang was a Bob Dylan song.
It was.
But Bob himself.
I could have picked 5 dozen others.
Yeah.
You know, there's endless supply of brilliant Bob Dylan
songs.
Well,
then why did you pick this one, Ring Them Bells?
Well, I think one of the things that I like and don't like about these records, the two records he made with Daniel Lanois, was that it made him kind of careful, about what he said. And it situated him in a position of power where every word counts and you really feel what he's saying. That's the plus side.
Yeah.
And say in Ring Them Bells, again, you could parse that out. What the hell is it about? But it's a warning about something. And it's biblical and it's saturated with all sorts of imagery. On the downside, I think whenever he finishes a record with Dan Lanois, the next record's usually better almost because it's freer and more effervescent.
Well, Lanois's got he builds a kind of a sonic structure.
But he slows him down a lot.
No, you could call it a structure or you could call it a cage if you wanted to.
Well, it's certainly, I think, it's like kind of, he puts a lot of grease on the wheel and the wheel slows down.
Yeah.
And if you listen to Dylan's records, the bootleg versions of a lot of the songs he did on the two Lanois records, they're much faster, much more.
But he did find a way, though, of getting Bob's voice up front again.
The message is everything to Lanois, I think.
Yeah.
And Dylan really delivers on the message.
Okay, ring them bells, Bob Dylan. Ring them bells, Bob Dylan, the choice of Iarla O'Linnard, who's with me in studio tonight. Iarla's picking all the tracks. You mentioned Joni Mitchell there. And she's, to my mind, in that kind of top tier of the songwriters. But I get the sense that a lot of blokes in particular don't pay as much attention to Joni Mitchell for the usual reason, because she's a girl. I think that's affected her, how she's perceived a lot of the time.
No doubt. I would be compelled to agree with you. I mean, as a composer, a writer of words and music, I don't think she can be matched.
And there's a genius about her which is astonishing, really, when you realise how young she was when she wrote some of the songs. And I cannot imagine. I mean, when I was 20, I couldn't tie my shoelaces, you know? And
I mean, she's a philosopher. She's a stupendously brilliant love poet.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's wise and it's mature and it's grown up, and you think, well, maybe she'd been through all sorts of experiences, you know, relationships and... But the understanding of relationships and so on is kind of astonishing for someone so young.
There's an honesty to her, which is, I really think... Well, I don't know how to say this, but I don't know if men can be that honest. She is so honest about the kind of train wreck of a lot of the relationships, you know. And we know what some of them were. We know who the man in question was.
Yeah.
But the way she pays homage to the train wreck is so profound and so beautifully executed. Her execution of that complex question of why did it go wrong, and often, as you've alluded to, she's more than happy that it went wrong.
Yeah.
Because she's restless and she wants to be on the road and she can't have what she wants. Whereas she doesn't want what she has.
I think Dylan, Springsteen, all the rest of them, much as I love them, and Leonard Cohen, all the rest of them, there's an element of posture about this sort of male sort of figure. Whereas Joni doesn't seem to care what you think of her so much, you know?
I think we know by now that she really doesn't give a hoot about that. She is, to me, in that sense, if there is such a thing, the pure artist, the untrammeled, unconfined artist, very sure voice, and just so profound in her observations of herself, her own failings, and the depth of her philosophical scrutiny is very touching, I find.
Now, you've chosen a version of Both Sides now. There's an orchestral version of it. Now, sometimes when artists re-record their songs and there's an orchestra, it doesn't work too well. But her orchestral versions have been pretty impressive, I think.
Well, a number of the songs that she has done, two records that have orchestral sort of cloth on them. And I think on balance that, you know, a fraction of them are brilliant, a fraction of the song, but they are so brilliant.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like about them is that they revisit these philosophical probings that she emerged with as a very young woman, but then she delivers them as a much, much older woman, a woman in her 60s even.
Yeah.
And
her voice is an octave lower. Almost.
It is, but also her soul is an octave lower.
Yeah.
And you have, what they say in Irish, Ciall Canaghe, you have the price of experience is written all over the voice. And it makes it so moving. I just think she's an absolutely towering vocal artist.
Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now, the choice of Iarla O'Linnard. It is extraordinary. I think we've decided now she is the greatest of them all.
I think she's it.
Yeah, I think she is.
She has to be right up there at the top, really. And it's just so, it's very pleasurable to give her the credit. Even though it's belated, I always was astonished by how good she was. Even just purely on the vocal side of things, her ability to sing, the way she does and write the way she did, guitar playing, as a side altogether from the lyrics, which are astonishing.
You said something to me there when we were listening to that, that reminded me of when you got a new record and you wanted to play it to your friends and you knew there was this kind of moment in it, and you get really annoyed if they talked over it, or they, you know,
they don't get it,
or they weren't paying attention, or worse again, didn't get it at all. But there's a sense that you get the emotion in something, but you want to share that emotion. You want someone else to experience exactly the same emotion listening to it, or a similar emotion.
You do. And that's why I picked that song, because I've often heard it in my own car when I'm driving, and I've often been very moved by it. And it reminds me to think about certain things that I need to think about.
Yeah.
And to take stock and take note. Because I think that's probably a secret power of some of these songs. They're a wonderful reminder of how to engage in some temporary quality thinking, you know, for want of a better phrase.
Mm. Would you ever cry at a gig? Not your own, now. I'm talking about that.
I would cry listening to records.
Mm.
I would.
Mm. And who would make you cry?
Maria Callas would.
Yeah. And do you know what she's singing? About, or is it just emotion?
I would know a little bit about what she's singing, but yeah. I don't need to know it all.
Yeah, okay.
But of course I do know what she's singing about.
Yeah.
Because actually what she's singing about is her own pain.
Mm.
And her ability to empathise with a shared sort of pain and ecstasy. You know, they're very close. One of the most powerful feelings that I ever get from listening to music, now that you mention it, is this idea of acceptance, of the harsh but beautiful temporariness of everything. But it's the acceptance that's very powerful, that relinquishing, that saying, yeah, this is it, this is it, and it's just great.
Mm.
But it's fractional, it's a blink.
And also, of course, music gets you to that spot that people who meditate and contemplate, and Buddhists in particular, talk about, the now.
Oh, no doubt about it.
That's one place where you will be in the now. And that's why I love jazz, I think, if I was to analyse it, because it is only happening once.
That's right, especially with jazz, because they're constantly swimming in all kinds of directions.
But it won't be the same again.
No, hopefully. Well, it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the thing about when you're listening to music too, I don't necessarily think it needs to be about something. I often think that where you go when you listen to music is you go into a zone of nothingness,
mm-hmm.
and a kind of a glorious emptiness,
mm-hmm.
which is, I know, sounds very zen, but I don't mean it that way. Because I'm not a practitioner, but in the music that I love most, that particular ecstasy is not about filling things up. It's actually about emptying the rubbish out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, just the sheer pleasure you can get from someone else's talent. You know, because, I mean, you're a singer, but you know, you don't have to be a singer to know that Maria Callas is something special.
You know, the thing about Maria Callas and people like that, your body will tell you before you have even time to think about
it. Yeah.
Something will change. Because when they reach those head voice notes, those special notes, those special decisions they make, and we don't know how they came to make those decisions. That is their true brilliance, that they make these decisions the way they do often. And it requires enormous cohesion of mind and body and spirit to get that instant sort of projection of that sound and idea. And Joni Mitchell can do that, and some other people I hope on the list too.
Actually, the next one on your list is one... This song could make me cry now.
Yes.
This could make me cry. Where are we now? David Bowie, the choice of Éireann O'Lynard. A lot of our guests, Éireann, you know, inevitably Bowie comes up as this totally transformative presence in their life when they discover David Bowie. And yet he was also just someone who was on top of the pops as well, but people tend to forget he was just another pop star at the time also. For you, what would Bowie represent, do you think?
Possibility.
Mm.
Endless possibility.
Yeah.
I mean, above all other artists I think that ever lived, he is the slipstream. He's not just in it.
Mm.
He kind of, even though, as we know, he would come late to the party, he would outdo the guys that came in first in whatever musical trend was happening, such that you forgot what came before. So, I mean, he did that repeatedly.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do that? You do it by, I think, a magical combination of things, including very hard work. We spoke about production earlier. I mean, he was obviously, a lot of artists don't get credit for their own production skills, but he was quite a genius producer and just a brilliant artist, I think. I think musician is far too small a statement for him.
Mm.
For me, he represents the possibility of continued change and the magical permission of that. And there's a reminder that we should always feel we can.
This is Mystery Train. My guest tonight, Éireann O'Leonard, is picking the music. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tunes. Éireann O'Leonard from The Gloaming is with me tonight. We haven't talked about The Gloaming yet, actually. We've talked about The Gloaming a lot before, I know. Before we even get to that point, though, your musical influences clearly are wide and broad, and, you know, a large element, quite typical of everybody else's, because, you know, you like Bowie and you like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and for people of the age you are, perfectly normal people to be into. Did any of this affect your approach to traditional singing, however? Did you absorb anything from these sorts of people?
Definitely. I mean, I don't really regard myself as sort of a thoroughbred Shannon singer, you know? I mean, I know where to go to hear that. I don't pretend to be that. Other people might ascribe that to me.
Yeah.
But I more see myself as a more mutated character than that, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, you know, you mentioned The Gloaming, or, for example, I do like to sing traditional songs with them. They perform a certain quotient of what we do because I just love those songs. But I don't try and sort of manufacture them in a situated time in the past. I much rather try and achieve something actually much more tricky, I think, which is to find a way of acknowledging how beautiful they are as artifacts,
mm-hmm.
whilst at the same time really enjoying them in the now and finding a way of just really making them sing now, you know what I mean? It sounds impossible, it actually kind of is, you know, so I'm just probably failing all the time, to be frank, but I'm trying to do that. And I think I try to do that because of my influences.
And I'm not suggesting for a minute you should care or give a hoot, but would you have people thinking, well, you shouldn't be doing this because the Shannon's thing, the traditional thing, is sacred?
There have been moments, of course there have,
mm.
of tension and things said to me.
And would it bother you?
It would.
It would bother you?
Well, it had.
Yeah.
I mean, it did.
Mm.
But, you know, in recent times, I suppose, I think, I may be entirely wrong about this, and it's okay if I am, I suppose. But I think, say, in my work with The Gloaming, for the most part, people have resonated with it because I think they find that for by whatever happenstance, we seem to have been able to maybe do those things which, at one instance, offer up the song to the now, but also pay homage to the original creators and the vision they had,
mm.
and the inherent beauty of the language, and the inherent beauty of the musical language from whence it comes. I think the combination of musicians in The Gloaming has allowed for that to happen in a very sort of a natural way. It doesn't seem fussed.
Now, when you guys got together, and there's yourself, Caoimhín O'Reilly, Martin Hayes, two fiddlers, very different fiddlers, different approach to things. Dennis Cahill on guitar, who's a one-off. And Thomas Bartlett, who really is a one-off. Did you know when you all got together for the first time what you were going to do, or what was possible? Was there a sense of the music that you guys might make, or did it all just start to happen?
It's a little bit messier than it's a bit of both.
Mm.
I think a lot of us knew the kinds of music we were interested in, both like in sort of post-minimal music, which we have an appetite for, most of us in the band, actually. And also our leanings to a certain type of traditional music, a certain intensity in the Irish music, a certain type of Irish trad music. There's so many types of Irish trad music. I think myself, Martin and Cuivín are perhaps unusual in that we love the really, really old music. The music from the very, very early recordings, the very early LPs, the sort of freedom within those temporally and sort of aesthetically, generally, they're kind of, there's a lot of variety. And there's a sonority to them that's really beautiful and strange. And Martin Hayes' sort of collapsed universe style of playing where everything is super slow.
Collapsed universe.
And it's just beautiful, you know. I know it sounds pretentious, but he kind of slowed everything down when he came up with that first record. And it kind of shocked people.
Yeah.
Where was the rhythm? What were you doing? But actually, he was hearing it just after just slowing down. And these tunes, like these dance tunes, they released a whole other energy. And I think Cuivín then, he just lives inside a sound. Mm. You know, he's a sound maker. We're all one-offs, I think. We're all awkward, mm-hmm. I think, with the general position of where we come from. I think we're all kind of awkward within our tradition.
Do you remember the first night? Do you remember the ovation?
I do, sure. I mean, it was shocking.
Were you shocked by that,
Jeff? I was, absolutely.
So when you guys went on stage, were you going on in a set? You know, what was in your mind when you went on stage that night? Did you think, we are going to show these people something they've never seen before in their lives and they're all going to stand up?
I wasn't thinking that.
No,
anyway.
Okay.
Not at all. I mean, you know, we did the opening set, which is now called the opening set.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a standing ovation. Mm. That's 15 minutes in. Mm. I mean, come on. Nobody would have any right to expect something like that. And I certainly had no notion.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's nothing to do with us.
All right, then. Who's it to do with? Or what's it to do with?
People have to make a choice.
Yeah.
The best I could come up with is that at times I think we satisfy a need that people have to connect with something. They're probably making those decisions themselves, what they want to connect with. It's very important for people to connect with each other, with a story that they can understand or even imagine for themselves. And because we've played all over the world, I can see it happening in other places too. And people ascribe a certain pathway to our journey. Mm. And it's really nice that they do.
Sure.
But it's them, you know. And we make records and stuff, but the live shows are a beautiful experience for us.
Mm.
You know, they really are. I don't know what's going on, really.
Your next choice actually features Cuivín.
Does.
With Cuivín. Dan Truman.
They're two extraordinary men. I mean, Cuivín plays this instrument, they both play this instrument, this hardanger d'amore, Cuivín calls it. And Dan Truman kind of invented this instrument. Dan Truman is a professor of composition in Princeton and currently actually a colleague of mine because I'm teaching there as well. But he invented this instrument arising from his vast experience of playing the Norwegian hardanger. He went to a gentleman in Norway called, I think his name is Salve Hakadal, and commissioned him to make a larger instrument with an extra top string and an extra sympathetic layer, viola-sized, played that. Cuivín went to America as a young graduate student working in a government laboratory on theoretical physics, high-energy physics. And I think the story is that the... I know... Well, actually, if you knew him better, you'd know that that's quite plausible.
That's our Cuivín. That's him.
But there you are. And the professor said to him, you know, I know a guy who plays fiddle. You got to meet him. So he meets Dan Truman. And then this extraordinary ball starts to roll and starts to collect snow until it's a huge snowball. And now I think there's about 15 of those instruments around the world. And, of course, they've come together to make this their first record. I think they've just made a second record. It will come out soon, I hope. And I think it's beautiful.
What's this track called, by the way?
It's called Lahan le Lahan.
Okay, Cuivín O'Reilly and Dan Truman. Cuivín O'Reilly there and Dan Truman, Lahan le Lahan, the choice of Iarla O'Linnard, who's with me in studio. Tonight, your next choice, I notice, is Peter Gabriel. You have a relationship with Peter Gabriel going back quite a bit to the Real World days.
Well, I do insofar as that, you know, I sent a begging letter one time to Real World when I didn't know what else to do. I think, and they wrote back, and he called, actually, and he left a message on my answer phone in Dublin. I was living in near Bullock Harbour at the time, and one of the fine people living in the house with me confiscated the tape, and she wouldn't relinquish it. I wouldn't love more money. She was such a huge fan of Peter Gabriel. She'd let me listen to it, but she wouldn't let me have it. So, you know, yes, I worked there for many years now. I'm with my previous incarnation with the Afrokel sound system, and I made some solo records with them too.
Yeah.
And actually the Gloaming are in the stable as well.
That's that place he had in Bath, and still has, I guess, the Real World Studios.
It's a very beautiful place.
Yeah, well, what's Gabriel's philosophy, do you think? What's his motivation? Because again, like you know, someone like him, you know, he could be playing polo or you know, driving fast cars and stuff. You know?
He's not typical, really. I mean, he's not a Mick Jagger. I mean, he's not Keith Richards in that sense. He, from the very beginning, I think what I was always fascinated about with regards to Peter Gabriel is his extraordinary curiosity in the musicking of other people's. Mm. You know, academics, of course, know all about music in Africa and India and Pakistan, but regular folks don't, because those musics don't have momentum within the media and where they live. And even now, even in this day and age of music equals data, it still is like that. There are still walls. But Peter Gabriel, seems to me, has never lived within those walls. His consciousness is very broad. I mean, his WOMAD festivals, his whole ethos of inclusion and excitement about music from other parts of the world. I mean, I've seen some amazing music at the various WOMADs from all over the world. I've met so many through him.
Did you see Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan?
I never saw Nusrat Fateh.
That's a regret of mine. I'd love to.
It is, but I did the next best thing, perhaps. I was in a studio with his nephews.
Yes.
Sitting on the floor.
Wow.
While they were recording.
Yeah.
And they were much younger then than they are now, but they were extraordinary then. But I mean, I think, and actually, in fact, that's how I first thought about reaching out to Real World, was when I heard the soundtrack to The Last Temptation.
Yeah.
And Nusrat, and there are many, many different kinds of things in that. But I think Peter Gabriel is a very thoughtful, gentle, interesting soul.
Hard to answer this question, but what did he make of you, for instance? I mean, I can see. I don't mean you're singing. What I can see why there might be an African band, which is basically, you know, there's some kind of dance music.
Yes.
And you go, this is dance music. This is that. You're going, this guy, this singer from Kool-Aid, you know, why do you think there was an appeal there for Gabriel? I mean, did he explain it, or did
he did, I suppose. You know, he's not very talkative, unlike me. He's a very reserved man. He's a lovely man. You always get the feeling, you always feel him.
Yeah.
Before you see him.
Really, yeah.
You always feel his presence. And I mean that sincerely. He goes after heart.
Mm.
You know, and if he hears that in the voice, and I think he also goes for some sort of transcendence. He searches for that. No, I think his music is folk music.
Mm.
Now, that might be a staggeringly stupid comment to make.
It's very folky.
It's very folky.
Yeah.
Despite all the trappings.
Oh, yeah.
But he does want to live inside that transcendent area in music. And I think aspects of the Shannos really appeal to him in that sense.
You've chosen a Peter Gabriel track, but it's all making sense here. It's a Paul Simon song.
I love this Paul Simon song. I love his version of it, of course, because Paul Simon's imagery is extraordinary. He is really, really, I think, as much a poet as a pop writer. I think Paul Simon is probably just the ultimate poet, really. But there's something about
the
way...
He's got a great band.
He has a great band. They're very smart.
Seriously?
They really are. He has two bands at any moment, the African band and his own band, and they really are. They're ridiculous. They're outrageous. They're so good. But it would make most musicians feel really sloppy and bad to see them.
And the private plane.
Oh, yeah. I know some folks that were on that.
No, we see, the reason I bring that up, when Paul Simon very, very kindly came over to do the Seamus Heaney event in the National Concert Hall, I was the MC, and and Martin came over with him.
That's right.
On the plane. But I didn't know he'd come over on this private plane. And I said to Paul Simon that as he was leaving that night, I said, oh, you know, what time's your flight? And he said, whatever.
Whatever. Yeah. That's the way to do it, eh? Paul Simon, though, is a class act. He's wonderful. His songs are so beautiful. You know, his imagery. He can be in the jungle and there could be a star and, you know, there can be a baby buggy with a bomb in it. There can be all kinds of things. But Peter Gabriel made a record some years ago of all these covers that he loved, and including, like, he did a cover of Heroes, which I think is beautiful because of its intimacy.
Yeah.
And in this recording with orchestra, you really hear one of the qualities that impresses me most about Peter Gabriel, which is the sheer beauty of the intimacy of his voice, the sound of his voice, the actual thing itself. And I think having the orchestra there allows him to move very close to us when he's singing beautiful songs such as this one.
And that's Peter Gabriel, the boy in the bubble, the choice of Éireann Ollinart, who's with me in studio tonight picking all the tunes. You like a good cover. And that's why I'm not surprised to see Susanna and the Magical Orchestra.
She does a lot of that.
She does a lot of them. And there have been too many covers done recently. You hear lots of, you know, bossa nova versions of all sorts of songs and all of that. But she's got taste, this one, Susanna and the Magical Orchestra.
She has more taste than most, no doubt. She has a pristine voice, probably one of my favourite voices in the world, because it is just such an incredibly fine instrument. And her judgment, her skill, her sound is just, it's just a very strange crystalline sound. Mm. But then also the involvement of her brother, Christian. The nature of the arrangements from which this song comes on that record, so stripped down and yet so satisfying. And this particular song written by Prince, I mean, Prince's version is like so full. Mm. It's like an explosion of colour. I wanted Prince on my list, of course, because Prince is made of music. I think of all the musicians I can think of, Prince is actually made of music. Mm. He is music to his fingertips. And his version of this song is like so full and crazy, and his vocalizing is so flexible and stunning. But what does she do? The impossible, actually, I think, which is just boil it down to what's really at issue. And it's a beautiful story of seeing someone and kind of falling in love with them and being hopeless.
Susanna and the Magical Orchestra.
There was a girl.
Susanna and the Magical Orchestra there, Condition of the Heart, Prince song, choice of Éireann Ollinart, who's with me in studio tonight picking the music. I'm enjoying these tunes, Éireann, very much. Brian Eno. Well now, how do you pick a Brian Eno track? Well, first of all, you don't want one that's 45 minutes long. That's the first first condition on this particular programme.
And or you don't want one with panels that light up.
No, it doesn't have...
Although that was tempting.
We can't afford an installation in here
tonight. I really wanted to bring one of those in.
It must be great to be someone like, you know, if you were a genius and you were capable of these things, but to devote your entire life, as he seems to do, to just making things.
It's incredible. And I mean, I mentioned the light panels because years ago, I remember being in Dublin, I'm talking 30 years ago or more, in Trinity, in Douglas Hyde Gallery, where he had an installation with all these panels. And really, it was like being on a starship. Mm. It was so other. And you got the sense of a man who, like you say, he has designed his life. He has designed his take on music too. But I also think he's been incredibly influential. Clearly he has.
Oh, hugely.
I mean, hugely. Mm. And also I think he has created an impenetrable bridge now, or an unbreakable bridge between popular music and art music. Mm. You know, there is no divide now because of him, largely. And there are others, but this whole idea of ambient music or...
Well, he'd be the route in for anybody, you know, listening to everything from Arvo Pärt to really old church music.
Precisely.
The really old stuff. I mean, there's nothing that strange about it if you know Brian Eno.
No, I mean, this is the thing with him. Like, I mean, this, I had, you know, close on 10 pieces, the long list, and for him alone.
Mm.
Because, like, I wanted to play something from Apollo, for example,
because
I just think it's so beautiful. I wanted to play some of his very early recordings that I bought on LP in Cork City as a 14-year-old. But I chose this one because it's a record he made relatively recently, and it's a record where he's singing.
He loves singing.
He loves singing.
He loves doo-wop, actually. That's what he loves.
And also my friend Leo Abrams is involved in the production of this record.
Okay, How Many Worlds, Brian Eno. Brian Eno there, the choice of Iarla O'Linnard, who's picking all the music tonight. Eno, eh?
We're not going to hear anymore, are we?
Well, we have to lash through this. We have to lash through.
We're on the lash.
We have to lash through this.
Brian is amazing, isn't he?
Well, he's extraordinary because he's so smart.
So smart.
And so, you know, he's the sort of person that, you know, if he was your pal, you'd be going out for a drink with him every night of the week just to have a conversation, you know?
He's in some way, I mean, in many ways, he's a philosopher of music, really. Mm. I think he's very thoughtful. I mean, but like I say, it's his ability to interpenetrate all the so-called walled-off territories of music that's a game-changer.
I remember an interview I did with him once, and this was, actually, this one was over the phone, I remember. And he was sitting in his yard, backyard, I'm sure it's a nice backyard, but I was asking about music and sound and all the rest of it. And he was obviously, as you know, very influenced by John Cage, and he met Cage and all that kind of stuff. But he said, well, I'll tell you something about music. He said, where I'm sitting here now, I can hear birds singing and all that, and that's fine. And he said, but I can hear a jackhammer in the distance. And he says, it's actually quite a pleasant sound. Do you know what I mean? He had that approach. He could hear. You know, I go to a gym and there's a guy in the gym with me who prefers the sound of the whirring machines to the music that they play in the gym.
That's his mantra.
But he finds music in the fan coming on.
Which, of course, is very Cagean. You
know, yeah, it's John Cage.
But, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, like, that the technology and the people, they come together in Brian Eno's generation. You know, those records he made with David Byrne, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and there was the Catherine Wheel, and they're just extraordinary works. And they are very much in that sort of cut and paste, found sound, with a very good riff and ideas. They're some of my favourite records ever.
And do you listen to a lot of music that someone like Eno would lead you to, into the outer reaches, in terms of, you know, more music that I suppose is largely more obscure? It's not really obscure because it's all available now. You can get it. You know, sort of stuff that, sort of Arvo Pärt, and all, that's not, obscure is the wrong word, but not mainstream, I guess, is what I'm saying.
No, I would. I mean, I remember I listened to lots of different kinds of ambient music because of him, like Rodelius, people like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've wall-to-wall Arvo Pärt. At this stage, he's well-known. But there are the thing about Brian Eno, too, that I didn't mention, which, you know, I mean, situates him well within the whole idea of church music in a sense. There is a sense of the transcendent in his music. I mean, there is the notion that music is taking you somewhere. Mm. There are some sort of a higher journey of awareness or whatever that is. Personally, I don't care what it is, except that it's a nice place to be.
See, and the two words you keep using throughout the program are intimacy and transcendence.
Well,
I suppose if you can do both of those, you're...
I feel it when I hear the artist I love to listen to. Mm. And that's what I want to hear in music.
Speaking of which, your next choice is someone who absolutely, in a live situation, when he is on, it happens like nobody else.
Absolutely.
You may know this guy. And that's Van Morrison there in a song called September Night, which is the last track, and sometimes the last track in an album, Earl, as you know, sometimes people don't get to the last track on an album sometimes, from an album called Inarticulate Speech of the Heart.
I think they didn't get to the last track of this album.
Artie McGlynn on guitar, actually,
yeah.
That album.
I love this album. It was panned by the critics, which means it was very good. And that part where he comes in with this, what can only be called a sort of an incantation, a chant, it's just profoundly beautiful. Mm. And I don't know where he's coming from, but I know that that's where Van Morrison likes to be.
Mm.
And that's what he brings to us.
Must be hard to get there all the time.
I think it's really hard to get there.
Because you can't phone that in, you know.
You can't. And I mean, here it is on a record forever.
Mm.
I mean, I just feel so privileged when I hear him bring us to that place. And it's just magnificent.
There are moments during Van Morrison concerts, and I've been to many, many of them, and I can still think of the best one where I was just, it was mind-blowing what was happening up on that stage. And I have no idea, you know. If you said to him afterwards, what were you thinking in the middle of that? He said, I was counting in the drummer. You know, this kind of stuff, which isn't true. I mean, he must have been gone somewhere to some degree.
And he probably doesn't know, to be honest. I don't think it's about knowing. I think the artist might be the last person to be able to tell you.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt in the case of Van Morrison that he's entirely unique in what he brings to the table. Like when you consider where he came from and what part of there he came from, and then his sort of take on Celticism and our music and the music of America, soul music, folk musics. It's just a beautiful, beautiful
Nobody else thing. Could have done that.
Nobody.
Nobody. Nobody. Nobody else is. Nobody else could, but also it had to be him.
It had to be him.
Yeah. Now this next one, we better lash into it quite quickly because it's a long one. Niels Frahm.
Yeah.
Niels Frahm makes the most extraordinary noises, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, I'm not a very well versed on Niels Frahm, except that I've heard, you know, 4 or 5 albums of his, and I couldn't believe that this one was live because it's so extraordinary. Mm. I just wish I'd been at it. But, you know, I've played it over and over, and I don't know how he achieves it. But again, it's beautifully episodic. It's almost what one might call modern symphonic. You know, it's kind of, it's very large scale when it needs to be. It has elements of Steve Reich, those sort of beautiful polyrhythms that are very insistent, and then these sort of manipulations at a deeper level using the bass end of the sonic spectrum, which really moves your innards just when it needs to, or maybe just a little late, which is even better, they tell me. It's very, very beautifully done.
And he tends to go for the ecstatic, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I suppose that is part of the form of large-scale installation-type electronic music making. You know, John Hopkins is another sort of person in that area, and there are others. And it's an interesting phenomenon, and a worthy phenomenon, I think, making communal music, or music where we can all sort of get into a shared space. I think it's very beautifully achieved, though, by Niels Frahm, because I think you have that sense of scale when he wants it, but then you also have, as I keep mentioning perhaps, this sense of intimacy, and it touches you in both those ways.
Said and done, live, Niels Frahm. Niels Frahm there, and Said and Done, the choice of Iarla O'Linnard, who's with me in studio. Just before we play the last track tonight, which will bring us right back to Areta, actually.
Mm. I thought it might have been a bit cheeky putting it in, but...
Not at all. Not at all.
I do love this version.
I want to ask you something profound before you go. You're the man for profound questions, you see. Take that as a compliment. All right,
I will.
I haven't thought of the question.
But I'm finding it hard.
I haven't thought of the question yet. I want to ask you this, Iarla. A few singers, I mean real singers like yourself that I've spoken to, not someone who just front a band, you know, but singers, say that they genuinely believe that when they're singing, they're connected in to all the people who sang before them, all the songs of the world. They're locked into some kind of, some big cosmos of singers. And some will use the term ghosts. Would you go that far?
Well, I think when I find that when I'm singing songs from centuries past, I definitely feel, I can say with honesty that I do feel and a very unusual set of feelings. Mm. Say, I remember last March I was on stage with Cuivín doing, with the Gloaming, doing that great song, Slán Le Moy, from Andreas McCrae, one of the last great poets from the Bardic School era. And I don't know, just there is something that happens. There is some phenomenology, if you like, that happens when we engage with these hard-won creations from the past.
Mm.
Because they're so beautifully made. I find myself reflecting on how beautifully made they are and on the depth and sincerity of expression that they contain, and trying desperately to answer that with honesty and as best one can. That brings me to a place I really like to be. I can't explain what it is, but I really love being there. And it's what keeps drawing me back to the old music. No matter how many songs I might write, and I love writing, nevertheless, when you touch a song that's 3 centuries old, it really is a magical place to be.
Erla, thanks a million for your time tonight. Thanks for picking all these tracks. Great to have you here. Great to see you.
Thank you so much, John.
And we're going to finish with Kate Ellis and her version of Aisne Gael. Erla, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.